Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And while the impeachment trial is dominating national political news, there are at least two other things President Trump did in the last day that shouldn't be overlooked. Speaking to reporters in Davos, Switzerland today, the president confirmed that he will add more countries to the existing travel ban. There are seven that have been mentioned in press reports: Belarus, Eritrea, Kyrgyzstan, Myanmar, Nigeria, Sudan, and Tanzania. Nigeria, I'll single out because it's Africa's most populous country with, as many of you know, or many of you are, members of a big diaspora here in New York and elsewhere in the U.S. They would be added to Iran, Libya, North Korea, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen for wide-ranging limits on visas to even enter the country. The president was elected, remember, after promising a total and complete ban on Muslims entering the U.S. This is how far the courts allowed him to get. And also at Davos, he called the U.S. a developing nation. He really did that this morning, a developing nation like India or China.
China's viewed as a developing nation. India is viewed as a developing nation. We're not viewed as a developing nation. As far as I'm concerned, we're a developing nation too. But they got tremendous advantages by the fact that they were considered developing and we weren't. And they shouldn't be. But if they are, we are. And we're talking about a whole new structure for the deal. Or we'll have to do something.
The president speaking this morning. For the record, the U.S. has 4% of the world's population, but 24% of the wealth, as measured by GDP. China has 19% of the world's population, 16% of the world GDP. India has 18% of the world's population and 3% of the world economy. Those numbers from the World Bank. But don't say Donald Trump is a psychologically shaky know-nothing. He calls himself a very stable genius. And that's the title of the new book by two of Washington's top White House correspondents, Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig from The Washington Post, who both join me now. The full book title is A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. It's great to see you two in New York and have you in our studio. Welcome in person to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having us, Brian.
We're excited to be here.
And remind everyone, where did that term, a very stable genius, originate?
These are the president's own words. Phil and I covered this presidency for 3 years, and we were really amazed by his choice of words, and we wanted to hold that sobriquet up to the mirror and test it and see what do people around him think about that title. Does it match their impression of working with him?
And was he prompted to say that early on when people were talking about 25th Amendment action kind of thing, you know, his cabinet removing from office for being psychologically unfit?
That's right, Brian. He first used that phrase in a tweet in January of 2018 amid a national discussion about his mental acuity, his psychological fitness to be the president. And he said, in fact, I'm a very stable genius. He then repeated the phrase 4 different times, including at a NATO summit in Brussels and most recently this past fall.
One of the new scoops in your book is that Trump once asked his first Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, to help him get rid of a law called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Can you remind us what that law is and explain why Trump wanted to undo it?
Happy to. This was a shocking moment to Phil and to me when we learned about this through our reporting. Basically, in a meeting at the White House, in the Oval Office, a couple of senior aides are talking with the president. They are discussing some business members who in America who are going to be prosecuted for bribing foreign officials. And that word, bribery, gets the president's attention. And he goes, wait, you know, we need to get rid of that law. that prohibits U.S. businessmen and companies from bribing foreign officials to get business overseas. He says it's just not fair. Our people should be allowed to bribe too. For the president, it was about leveling the playing field. The guy is always thinking in terms of like a businessman, like, and he has been opposed to this law, actually, we learned, since 2012, long before he was a candidate.
But if people aren't like shaking their radios and phones right now hearing you say that, then it's an indication of how much we've normalized everything Trump. The president of the United States, you are reporting, wanted to legally enable bribery by U.S. companies in other countries.
You know, I agree that it was stunning, and that's why we've included it in the book, and we do think it's pretty interesting. There is one other thing to say about it, Brian, which is it really connects us to this moment in time. The president has said that the only reason he was pressing Ukraine's president to do an investigation of Joe Biden and the Biden son is because he cares about corruption. The president hasn't said it in those many words, but his White House folks are defending him literally on the Senate floor this week on this idea that he just wants to root out corruption. In this instance, we find he wanted to encourage and enable fair, equal playing field corruption.
Yeah, and I was thinking about a tie to this moment too, because he thinks asking for a corrupt deal like Ukraine launching a misinformation campaign against Joe Biden in exchange for U.S. aid is a perfect phone call. So it's part of a pattern.
It is part of a pattern, Brian. And one of the things that we document in A Very Stable Genius is how much throughout these 3 years of the presidency, Trump has been motivated by dollars and cents, by making a buck in this office. That's, of course, because of his roots as a real estate mogul, where he's constantly selling and pitching and marketing products. But he's in private meetings with the Pentagon brass saying that our troops who are deployed in countries all around the world and in bases all around the world, that we should be making a profit off of them. Other countries should be paying rent, so to speak, in order to have American troops there. That has not been the reason America has deployed troops around the world historically. And it really alarmed the Pentagon leaders that we spoke to for this book exclusively.
So the U.S. did not undo the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So what does your reporting tell us was Secretary of State Tillerson's response when the president raised that possibility?
First, he was just floored, according to the sources that we spoke to who were privy to that meeting. He could not understand why the president believed his Secretary of State could undo a law. You know, he wanted, it was kind of like a schoolhouse rock moment for Tillerson and other aides. Like, do we need to explain to him how you get rid of a law? It's not the Secretary of State. So eventually, instead of having an argument with the president, we're told Rex Tillerson says, "I'm just not your guy." Later in a hallway, a senior aide to the president, Stephen Miller, explains to Tillerson, "You know, this probably isn't going to work out exactly." The president had asked Miller, a very loyal aide, by the way, "Well, if Tillerson isn't going to do it, can we get an executive order to undo this law?" Ultimately, it never happens.
I'm curious, how did that relationship go so bad? Trump made Tillerson his Secretary of State, partly because Tillerson was CEO of ExxonMobil, and maybe it was the symbolism or, you know, the relationships that came with that. Obviously, a huge company that had relationships with many governments, but it would also seem like a good fit for a president who wants his foreign policy to be somewhat about doubling down on fossil fuels. So what happened there?
You know, Brian, the relationship devolved from the beginning, but we should point out that Trump and Tillerson didn't know each other until the transition when Trump was assembling a cabinet. They had one interview at Trump Tower. Trump liked Tillerson's resume. What's not to like, right? CEO of one of the world's biggest companies. He loved that he had this gravitas and swagger when he walked into a room. He looked the part, and Trump was assembling the government in a central casting way. But then once he became Secretary of State, it was painfully obvious to the president, to Tillerson, to everyone else in the administration that these two men had different worldviews. Tillerson was protecting the America's alliances that were built after World War II. He was, to use the Steve Bannon phrase, a globalist. Trump wanted to tear everything up. He wanted to break the China and rebuild it. He wanted to be friends with Vladimir Putin. Tillerson was warning Trump about the dangers of being friends with Vladimir Putin, and the relationship devolved. And by the time Tillerson was fired, he actually never was given a rationale for his firing, and was fired while he was on a diplomatic trip to Africa in order to mend fences because of the president offending African leaders.
My guests, if you're just joining us, are Philip Rucker and Carol Lennig from The Washington Post. Their brand new book is called A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. We can take a few phone calls for them, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And so I don't forget at the end of the segment, and listeners, for your planning purposes, if you want to see these as seen on TV, Washington reporters in person, Philip Rucker and Carol Lennig will deliver the Columbia University Journalism School's Delacorte Lecture. And that's going to be on Wednesday, February 5th at 6 o'clock in Pulitzer Hall on Columbia's campus. That'll be open to the public at the time. And you can find more information on the Journalism School's website. It's journalism.columbia.edu/events. But again, they'll be giving this year's Columbia J School Delacorte Lecture on Wednesday, February 5th at 6 o'clock. Obviously, you weren't in Davos this morning, unless they have really fast transportation that I don't know about yet.
The old Concorde.
Exactly. But can we look at what he said about the U.S. being a developing nation like India through, I don't know, maybe through the lens of originally tapping someone like Tillerson at all?
There's something to me about his comment about developing, and especially mentioning India, that relates directly to the book, Brian, which is, so many of the people who served at President Trump's shoulder for months and years told us he's, quote unquote, dangerously uninformed. There are many times that he just doesn't seem to understand the American story. He doesn't understand world geography. He didn't know what happened at Pearl Harbor. He, on a trip to Asia, he completely floored his chief of staff, John Kelly, by saying when they were about to tour the USS Arizona and Hawaii, "What's this all about, John?" With regard to China and India, he once, in a very, very sensitive negotiating meeting with the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, he actually said, "Hey, you know, it's not like you've got China on your border." Actually, he's got hundreds and thousands of miles of border with China. So it was the use of the word developing doesn't surprise me based on the reporting we've done.
Let's take a phone call. Alan in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Hi. Does the book go into issues regarding Trump's literacy, his basic ability just to read from the teleprompter, etc.? He's displayed at certain times the word S-C-O-U-R-G-E. He pronounces it scourge instead of scourge. Yeah. Issues like that of literacy.
I know people ask this kind of question. I'm not sure there's anything there. Is there?
You know, we certainly don't diagnose the president in the book. We're not equipped to do that. But there are moments and scenes, including one where he was filming a documentary with HBO of reading the Constitution, and he's got the text of the Constitution, Article 2, in front of him in a teleprompter. And Trump had so much difficulty reading that passage of the Constitution cleanly. Of course, this is an old language written as the Founding Fathers did it, but it became painfully clear to those in the room who we spoke to for the book that Trump was not familiar with this document. He had clearly not studied it, maybe hadn't even read it before. This is the document he swore an oath to protect and had difficulty getting through it. We also document how his intelligence briefers had to brief him with graphics and charts and videos and maps and pictures because he wouldn't read the intelligence briefing. He didn't have the patience to read a one-page memo, let alone a 10-page memo every morning. And so they looked for other ways to give him information.
There is this sad moment where his national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, a general, is realizing that Donald Trump isn't reading the most important, holiest of holy intelligence document, the presidential daily brief. So he decides to make it a one-pager. But word comes back from the Oval Office. I think it was Rob Porter, as we report, who says, "You know what? We can't even take a one-pager. Can you turn it into three bullets?" This is a president who doesn't like to read.
Is there a danger, though, for Trump critics especially, and on a different level for journalists, in portraying Trump as not up to the job? Like, you know, the title of the book is an ironic quote of Trump himself, calling himself a very stable genius. But maybe he does have a certain kind of instinctual political genius, and within his own parameters, I know he seems to flip-flop on certain things at certain times, but there is a certain consistency to him that his supporters relate to, and maybe that's why, you know, the support that he has in the population is about the same as it was when he was elected.
You know, in the book, Phil and I both give him proper credit, and he is due this credit for the genius of how he is connected with voters. There's a scene in the book where Don McGahn, who is basically a very, very good campaign lawyer and is being urged to consider working for Donald Trump and representing his campaign in 2015, and he's urged by a colleague of his, Dave Bossie, a conservative icon and activist, to come see this Donald Trump in action. And when he does, he is stunned. He says, he tells other people, this guy connects with voters like you cannot believe. The forgotten, the white working class who believe that there's been all this disdain and looking down their noses from the political class. And he's going to be their champion. And so he is a genius in that regard.
Rick on Long Island, you're on WNYC with Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker from The Washington Post. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Phil and Carol, I love your reporting. I try to read as much as I can and watch you as much as I can. I'm just a little bit curious with regards to a story that came out a few days ago when Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis attempted to perhaps, and I think Gary Cohen was involved in that meeting, where they were perhaps trying to change the president's view of how things got done and military operations. And the quote that stunned me was, "You're all a bunch of babies and dopes." And I think that, I believe, is where Tillerson was quoted. He had the moron quote afterwards. I won't use the expletive. I'm just curious, during your reporting and subsequently, gathering for this book, what did you find out and what are you really hearing out there?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking that question. That was one of the most dramatic moments in the book that we found, and it took a lot of rigorous reporting to get there. This is a meeting that took place in the tank, which is a sacred space inside the Pentagon, in the summer of 2017. It was on the president's public schedule. The details of the meeting have been reported numerous times before, but the full story hasn't come out until now in a very stable genius. And through interviews with people who were in that room, firsthand witnesses, they documented exactly what the president said when he confronted the military leaders. They were trying to give the president a tutorial on the world, and in turn, the president told them, "I wouldn't go to war with you people, and you're a bunch of dopes and babies." And it was a harrowing, really scarring moment for the military brass, and nobody stood up to the president except for Rex Tillerson, who has not worn the uniform, was a private businessman beforehand, and he just, you know, really told the president that is not why soldiers go into battle, that is not that he shouldn't be disrespecting them, and afterwards had called the president an effing moron. I won't use the expletive either. But it was a moment that is instructive for the current moment we're in right now, because we're on the precipice of war with Iran, perhaps. These are the very generals and commanders that Trump is going to be relying upon to lead American troops into battle or to make decisions about that war. And at this moment, this episode from 2017, just illustrates the disrespect he had for them.
So why, Carol, after episodes like that, are people willing, or Philip, if this is more in your portfolio, are people willing to take those jobs, you know, after Rex Tillerson, after this one, after that one, even in the military chain of command, why are people willing to be Donald Trump's aides, and what do we think of them?
You know, Brian, the trajectory of this presidency, as documented with this rigorous reporting and interviews with more than 200 sources that Phil and I met with, is about increasingly a presidency of one, and the guardrails are gone. He has driven a lot of the people out of the room who were trying to hem him in or give him counsel or give him information. And increasingly, he is surrounded by people who view their mission as getting him to yes, or getting themselves to yes with him, enabling him and encouraging whatever impulse he has. it's an interesting time. I do think that there are, based on, again, on our interviews, a lot of people who go to work for this president because they believe that they can achieve their own agenda in this time. There are Republicans who still think, hey, we can get more judges on the courts. We can get more done with regard to the border. We can get a lot of things done about criminalizing certain acts that haven't been criminalized properly. He is their ticket, their medium. But there's a cost to it because they're going to have to say yes a lot.
On the border, you report on the president repeatedly trying to shut down the border with Mexico, not patrol it, not just build a wall, shut the border down. How did he try to do that? And when you say repeatedly, how many times?
Repeatedly. I don't even think we could count on our hand. But there's one vivid scene in the book that's a cabinet meeting where the president is trying to get his cabinet to shut down the border. And at this point, he had grown increasingly frustrated with Kirstjen Nielsen, who was the Homeland Security Secretary. He not only berated her personally for not having the look, quote unquote, because she was so short to be at the border. But he was just frustrated with the influx of migrants. And in this meeting, he said, we need to close the border. And Nielsen confronted the president and said, you can't do that. That's against the law. We can't just shut down the border. People have a law to cross the – or people are legally allowed to cross the border and claim asylum. And it became a really tenuous moment in their relationship. Jared Kushner is in the cabinet room sort of crossing his finger across his neck to try to get Kirstjen Nielsen to shut up. Jeff Sessions, then the attorney general, intervened to back up the president, even though he knew it was illegal to shut down the border. And these border conversations continued for months to come until ultimately Nielsen was forced to resign.
So related to that, can I get a take from you on the news from this morning on the additions to the travel ban that the president is now announcing? He confirmed the idea that he will be adding other countries. According to press reports, 7 more countries would be added, mostly with large Muslim populations, even Nigeria, which has a large U.S. population, which among other things is a U.S. anti-terrorism ally.
So we're journalists. We don't react or have takes exactly. But I'll tell you that Phil and I did a lot of reporting with people about the moments involving the travel ban. It was a rush job, to put it mildly, when he started this.
First week of the administration.
Yes. Never even showed a actual final draft to the people who were his cabinet members who would have to implement it. And I think that you'll find that his announcement now relates a lot to the fact that we're in a campaign cycle. He has promised people he's going to get tougher on who gets to come into the country, and this is another way to remind them that he's doing just that. I'm struck, too, by some great Washington Post reporting done by our colleague Josh Dossi about what the president called some of the countries that are on this list, this added list, which I can't repeat because it's an epithet, but suffice to say they were called something whole countries.
Is that the incident that a lot of our listeners know about from that meeting a few years ago where he called a lot of African countries plus Haiti and El Salvador, I think, that blank hole countries?
Yes, it is.
That's the same one. So are you saying, Carol, that your reporting indicates that in re-election terms, here we go again with anti-Muslim and anti-Latino fervor for the race ahead?
I can't tell you what the president's motivations are. I can just tell you what I've seen in our reporting about what usually motivates him, which is, I'm going to tell my base that I'm looking out for them. I'm going to show them that I can deliver for them time and time again. And we are in the heat of that cycle right now.
Do you document anything we could call Trump's feelings about race and identity or his use of race and racism for political ends?
You know, we document some of it, but we focus so much more on the decisions that he was making in office and the way in which he was testing the boundaries of the norms in this country and the Justice Department and the Pentagon and the Defense Department. I would add to that prior discussion between you and Carol about the anti-Muslim fervor, that Trump used that, stoked that to great effect politically in 2016. It's one of the reasons he won the presidency. And to the extent he's going to try to do that again, I expect that to be the pattern because he found success the first time. And he and his team are probably calculating that they will find success doing it again.
We also had a window into his views on race from one of his very closest assistants and confidants. You might remember, or your listeners may remember, his personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, who testified that in private conversations, Donald Trump said many what he viewed as racist things. In fact, it was one of the three words he used to describe Donald Trump, racist. We don't say that in our book, but Michael Cohen recounts the president driving through a low-income neighborhood in Chicago that was primarily African-American and saying only these stupid people would live in these conditions.
Yeah, and I noticed recently, I guess something that I've been thinking about, I don't know if it's crossed anybody else's mind, that he called Soleimani the other day a son of a bitch, and it was only the second time that he slapped anyone with that, I believe. The other time was for NFL football players who kneel to protest police brutality. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that moment, that use of that with respect to the football players is referenced in your book at all. I'm fishing.
Wait, you're fishing, Ryan. We don't get into the NFL kneeling controversy, but there are just so many controversies. If we did everything, it'd be a 900-page
yes,
book.
I understand.
Nobody wants to read that.
Well, I'm going to cast one more line then before we run out of time on Trump and Vladimir Putin. You have one scene where Trump seems anxious to get a meeting with Putin. The New York Times review of your book says he was like a Putin fanboy in this scene.
Yes.
Tell us what that was about. But then, and we're just about to run out of time, but in the bigger picture on that, did you come any closer to figuring out why Trump has a Putin thing? People speculate it's compromise, or it's wanting to have Putin's autocratic powers for himself, or it's liking his retro-masculine style.
Mm.
What happened in that incident, and how close do you come to figuring out why he has a Putin thing?
So even before he is inaugurated, the president is asking, can I meet Putin? Can we do it before the inauguration? Can I get a meeting with him? And it stuns the people around him because, first off, it would be a completely political political explosion if you were to meet with the leader of an adversarial country that has tried to attack us in lots of ways before you meet with our allies. It was just sort of stunning that this is what he wanted. But again, it's an indicator of the president's view, which is he busts every norm. These protocols and norms be damned. However, your question about why, that still perplexes even our sources. Why was it so important to him to cozy up to Putin? H.R. McMaster asked his staff all the time and lamented and said, this is the national security advisor for most of Donald Trump's tenure, I don't know why he likes this guy so much. I don't know why he wants to be friends. And he would often lament, I don't know why he believes Putin. They started to feel in the national security team at the White House that the president was naively believing everything Putin would say. And that worried them, too. There's something larger, too, Brian, which is the president just generally cozies up to autocrats. Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey, he said some beloving things in a way of other autocrats. It's not just Putin. But that seems to be a center and a through line about the foreign leaders he wants to be buddies with.
Carol Lenig is a national investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Philip Rucker is their White House bureau chief. Together, they have written A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. And again, if you want to see them in person, they will be giving this year's Columbia University School of Journalism Delacorte Lecture. That's on Wednesday, February 5th at 6 o'clock in Pulitzer Hall on the Columbia campus. It's open to the public, but you can get more information at journalism.columbia.edu/events. So great to see you in person in New York. I'll continue to follow your work in Washington.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian
Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.